We finished up Joshua last week in our study through the Bible. And Joshua, as he was getting pretty old, it was interesting that the Lord had told him, "Hey, Joshua, you know, you're getting pretty old." And as he said, that was in, what was that, chapter 13. Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years." You just got to appreciate a God who says it like it is. And he said, you know, there's a lot of the territory left to conquer. And God let us in on the fact that he allowed them not to fully conquer all at once. He gave them a reason a long time ago, saying, if I gave you the whole land at once, there wouldn't be enough of you in the land, and it would be overrun with wild beasts. You couldn't possess it all. But there were also other reasons that God said that he would not bring, like, drive out all the Canaanites immediately. So as Joshua was getting older and wasn't going to be able to lead them, he led them into the land. He led them in a lot of victories, but wasn't going to be able to lead them in all the victories. And so God said, okay, you need to divvy up the land now. You need to apportion out the territories to the various tribes, and then they will drive out the Canaanites in their area. And so that's where we left off when Joshua had died, and we pick up in Judges chapter 1. It came about after the death of Joshua that the sons of Israel inquired of the Lord, saying, well, who should go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? The Lord said, Joshua shall go up. I mean, Judah. We're going to prop him up with a stick? Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand. So Judah said to Simeon, his brother, in other words, the tribe of Judah contacted the tribe of Simeon and said, well, come up with me into the territory allotted me, that we may fight against the Canaanites, and I, in turn, will go with you into the territory allotted you. So Simeon went up with him. So here's some brotherhood and some teamwork happening. And they did end up, they fought against the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and they defeated them. It says in verse 8 that they fought against Jerusalem, part of, remember, Jerusalem wasn't the capital of Israel at this point. It was under Canaanite occupation. It was their city originally. And so the sons of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it, struck it with the edge of the sword, and set the city on fire. And so they take Jerusalem and a lot of their territory. But if you go down to verse 19 of chapter 1, you see that the Lord was with Judah, and they took possession of the hill country, but they could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had iron chariots. The inhabitants of the valley had iron chariots, and so the sons of Judah could not drive out the Canaanites. You say, hold on, time out. I thought God said they could do anything. Well, they could do anything. It wasn't God's fault that they couldn't do this. It was their own fault. As a matter of fact, back in the book of Joshua in chapter 17-ish or so, so if you turn to the book of Joshua, chapter 17-ish or so, what you see is at the very last part of, chapter 17, the hill country shall be yours, though it's a forest, you'll clear it. He says, you shall drive out the Canaanites, even though they have chariots of iron, and even though they are strong. God had promised them, you are able to do this. It's a natural, it's a physical impossibility, but you can do all things in me. And so, regardless of the iron chariots, God had warned them in advance, when you go into the land, you're going to see that they have iron chariots. This is military, technological, weaponry superiority that you don't have, and yet you will be victorious. God had told them that, made that promise to them in advance, and yet they couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. They couldn't muster enough faith to believe that they could go to battle against the Canaanites because they had iron chariots. And so they didn't. And then as chapter 1 goes on, you see that it lists the various tribes and how there were certain people, certain of the Canaanites, that they would not or could not drive out. So it says in verse 21 that the sons of Benjamin didn't drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. And then ultimately in verse 28, it says that when Israel became strong, they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they didn't drive them out completely. They decided, well, you know, it's just too difficult to drive them out completely. Maybe we'll just try and peacefully coexist. We will be the strong nation here. We will put them to servitude. And so what we see is they were not faithful to drive out the Canaanites the way God said to. He said, eliminate them completely, and they didn't. Now, that stands to reason that we should take that and learn from it and realize that God has said, drive sinful habits out of our lives completely, and yet we try to peacefully coexist. We say, well, I'll just cut down. I will be the master. You know, I'll just let this sin have an area of my life, and you know, we'll peacefully coexist. Well, it doesn't work because you can't last like that. You just can't. As a little bit of compromise leads to a lot of compromise. A little bit of allowance leads to a lot of allowance. Well, not for kids, you know. But wouldn't it be great if a little allowance amounted to a lot of allowance? But when you allow sin to remain, it will grow and it will become strong and it will bring you down. And so ultimately, chapter 2, verse 11 says, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. The Baals, the Canaanite supreme false god, the only reason that they served the Baals was the fact that they hadn't driven out the Canaanites and eliminated the idolatry of the Canaanites the way they were told. They compromised, and their compromise led to big compromise. And so they forsook the Lord. And let's read the rest of the chapter because this really sets the tone for Judges, and it's a nasty tone. It's a pretty bad situation in the book of Judges. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who are around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtoreth. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil. As the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so that they were severely distressed. You remember that they had the option. They walked between the Levites walked between the tribes, the Mount Baal or Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, the blessing and the curse. And they recognized, hey, we'll be blessed if we do this. We'll be cursed if we do this. Now they're being cursed. And so they were severely distressed. But you know what? The Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. That is, by the way, where we get the name of the book of Judges, because it's going to show us this cycle of the people falling into sin, crying out to God, and God raising up a judge to deliver them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down quickly to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do as their fathers. When the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed and afflicted them. But it came about when the judge died that they would turn back and act more corruptly than their fathers. In following other gods to serve them and bow down to them, they did not abandon their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. And he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not listened to my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, in order to test Israel by them, whether they will keep the way of the Lord to walk in it as their fathers did or not. So the Lord allowed those nations to remain, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. And so this is the story. He says, this is why I left these nations around, that they would be the test. That we'll leave them around after Joshua dies. Joshua, you know, he was a righteous leader. He kept them whipped into shape, you know, and wouldn't let them fall into sin. And when they did fall into sin, he brought correction immediately, as was the case with Achan. You remember that he had taken some of the valuables which were under the ban, and Joshua dealt with it. He would not tolerate unrighteousness in the camp. Well, in order to test the people to see if, look, are you obeying because of fear of Joshua or fear of God? Well, after Joshua died, the Lord left the opportunity for them to sin or not to sin. See, it wasn't just in the Garden of Eden when there was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. that mankind had a choice. In fact, God has always presented mankind with a choice. There will always be sin in our midst, and we can choose to reject it, or we can choose to give in to it. And so here he left these nations, and they proved what was really in their hearts. They were following because of Joshua, not because of their love for God. And also in this, we see the cycle. And I shouldn't really call it a cycle, because it's more like a downward spiral. But you can map this out, that you could see that at the top of this circle, you could see God blesses his people, and things are easy. And you go around the circle, and you see that the people fall into compromise, fall into sin, they reject the Lord. As a result of them rejecting the Lord gives them into the hand of their enemies. As a result of them being given into the hand of their enemies, they cry out to God. As a result of crying out to God, God raises up a deliverer and delivers them, and now things are easy for the Israelites again. What happens after that? They go through the circle again. They forsake the Lord. They are oppressed. They cry out to God. God raises up a judge. Things are easy. And it goes around and around. However, the reason I say this is a spiral and not a circle, it really goes down like this, because each generation would do worse than the generation before. That they would come back, it said in verse 19, turn back and act even more corruptly than their fathers. And so it's a downward spiral of repetition, getting worse and worse and worse. So we see that the nations are not driven out. Chapter 3, verse 5 says that the sons of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And look at this. They took their daughters for themselves as wives, gave their own daughters to their sons, and served their God. They began to intermarry, the very thing that God had told them not to do. The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Ashtoreth. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel so that he sold them into the hands of this guy, king of Mesopotamia. And and the sons of Israel served this guy 8 years. When the sons of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer. So you see this cycle. It's happening again. They cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the sons of Israel to deliver them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel. When he went out to war, the Lord gave the king of Mesopotamia into his hand so that he prevailed over him. You like that? Then the land had rest 40 years, and Othniel, the king the son of Kenaz, died. So what do you think is going to happen? The land has rest. The judge dies. What happens? We go through the circle again. And so the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And he gathered to himself the sons of Ammon and the son of Amalek and went and defeated Israel, and they possessed the city of the palm trees. The sons of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. 18 years of servitude before the people recognized this is because of our sin. We need to cry out to God. 18 years. So verse 15, after 18 years here, when the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. Now, I'm a left-handed man, and I have to wonder why God... I don't know. Maybe you have a better joke than I'm about to tell. I don't know. No, when you read this, you have to wonder, why is he pointing out that the guy's a left-handed man? Well, you'll see as you read the story that it goes further. I wish I knew what was funny. I would have told that joke. But you notice this, that the times were difficult, that Eglon, the king of the Moabites, has occupied them, has crushed them and persecuted them, and for 18 years the Israelites are serving the Moabites. 18 years. You know, it takes me about 18 hours to realize that when problems come upon me for sin, that I need to repent. Sometimes it's even 18 seconds, but usually it's more into the 18 hours. I cannot imagine knowing the Lord and spending 18 years in darkness. I can't imagine enduring and suffering. As David, when he sinned with Bathsheba, he sinned against Bathsheba, but he sinned with Bathsheba, and he tried to cover it up. And David wrote Psalms during that time, or after that time, when he finally confessed his sin, talking about how he was just laying in bed, wasting away, that his whole body was sick and racked with pain and was deteriorating because he was holding that sin inside. He wasn't confessing it, and he wasn't repenting for it. It's like, what a horrible place to be. And you know Christians that are maybe in that season even right now, that are just holding it in. They're refusing to be broken by the Lord. They're refusing to repent. And they're just, man, how long are you going to do that? And maybe you've come out of a lengthened season of failing to be broken by the Lord. Don't let it be 18 years. And we hope that those who you know, that you're praying for them, that it won't be 18 years for them either. In this case, Israel took 18 years to cry out to the Lord. But the Lord heard them, and he raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud. Ehud's a left-handed guy. And the sons of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. So they had to pay. You know, the Moabites said, basically, we're the bad guys now. We are stronger than you. If you don't send money to us all the time, it's like an extortion thing. If you don't send money to us, we'll send our armies to you, and we'll just wipe you out and kill as many of you as it takes before you start sending the money again. So Ehud is the guy whose job it is this time to send tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab. Now, God moved in this guy's heart, and he's a left-handed man, and that really does factor into the story, because left-handed people are pretty rare. I mean, they're unique at least, but they're pretty rare. And so the Moabites, being so strong and being used to the Israelites, who were right-handed guys, that when the security guards outside of the king's palace would frisk you for weapons, that, I mean, they got so lazy that they thought, well, you know, that when a guy grabs his sword, he's gonna grab it, you know, you grab it across your body here. And so if you're right-handed, you'll grab it off of your left-hand side and you'll whoosh, pull it out and you'll go to battle. Well, they got so lazy, and they really didn't encounter any left-handed people, that when the guys walked in bringing tribute, you know, these weak and sniveling Israelites, they'd pat him down on the left leg and just, okay, go on in. Well, Ehud saw how this happened, and so he made himself a sword, two-edged sword, a cubit in length. It's just a short thing, about 18 inches, a cubit being the measurement from a man's elbow to his fingertips. And so a sword this big, and being a left-handed guy, he's going to hide it on his right side where the guards aren't going to be patting him down. And so he bound it on his right thigh under his cloak. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. You got a left-handed guy. It sounds like a joke. A left-handed guy and a fat guy walk into a bar, you know. And it came about when he had finished presenting the tribute that he sent away the people who carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the idols which were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, oh, keep silence. And he sent everybody out. And so the guys carrying all the treasure of the Israelites were sent on ahead. The guys that were in the palace were sent out because the king's going to hear a secret. You know, nothing will get you in trouble faster than go, oh, I want to hear a secret. And so he said, I have a secret message for you. And he sent everybody out. Verse 20, Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat. Ehud stretched out his left hand, took his sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. There's your message from God, buddy. Here's the secret. Make sure you hide this secret well. Well, the handle also went in after the blade, and the fat closed around the blade, for he did not draw the sword out of his belly, and the refuse came out. Ugh. This is a fat guy. Okay, you've got a sword this long. It gets thrust in, and he's so fat that the sword actually disappears. You know, and the fat's like, you know, kind of rolling over. It disappears, but the refuse comes out. This is, by the way, this story when I was the jack of all trades at our church in Oregon, the assistant pastor and the children's ministry director and the bookstore manager and the office administrator, all kinds of things. And so being the children's ministry director and having a number of teachers that were kind of flaky in regards to showing up for their class, I frequently ended up just on the spur of the moment having to teach Sunday school classes to kids. This story got taught so often in my classes. They loved it. They told us the story about the fat king with the stuff coming out, you know. And they loved this. And hopefully that's not being taught to your kids every week downstairs. I'm sure it's not. Then Ehud went into the vestibule, shut the doors of the roof chamber behind him, locked them. When he gone out, the servants came and looked, and behold, the doors of the roof chamber were locked. And they said, oh, he's only relieving himself. You know, why are the doors locked? Oh, he's probably going to the bathroom. So they waited until they became anxious. Behold, he did not open the doors of the roof chamber. Now, I know this is probably a sick question, but how long do you wait when you think a fat king is going to the bathroom before you start getting suspicious? Therefore, they took the key, opened them, and behold, their master had fallen to the floor dead. Now, Ehud escaped while they were delaying. So they waited long enough for Ehud to get, you know, out of the castle and out, pretty much out of town. They waited quite a while there. And so then Ehud raises up the Israelites, and they ended up striking down at that time about 10,000 Moabites, it says in verse 29. Verse 30, so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land was undisturbed for 80 years. Oh, but Ehud's going to die, you know, and so the cycle repeats, and then Shamgar becomes a judge, and his story is that he struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. Well, then he dies and the circle goes through again. And as we go through Judges, pretty much at this point, we'll just be hitting the highlights. We'll just be hitting the lowlights of Judges. That's pretty much what you have. And so again, chapter 4, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord sold them into the hands of Yabin, king of Canaan. Now, Deborah, it says in chapter 4, verse 4, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time. Now, Deborah, now that's unusual to have a woman be the judge of Israel, that up to this point, all through the Bible, it's been guys. And yet, you will see that it's clear from the text in the context of chapter 4 that God is not gender biased. It's, you know, he opens the opportunity up to guys, and if they don't take it, if no guy's available, he'll put a woman in the place. God will not be hamstrung by a bunch of guys being a bunch of wimps. And that's, in fact, what is going on here, because she, judging Israel, summoned Barak and says, hey, the Lord has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor, take 10,000 guys. And the Lord says in verse 7, I'll draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Yabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. God says, Deborah, I want you to tell Barak, I'm raising him up to be a victorious army guy. You know, he's going to be victorious here. Well, Barak says, if you will go with me, then I will go to Deborah, this woman sitting. If you go to battle with me, please. But if you won't go with me, I won't go. Man, this was the greatest guy in Israel at the point, the one that God said, hey, let's raise you up. Well, I don't want to go by myself. She said, I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman. So ultimately, they get this army together. Sisera, the commander of this army, gets all his 900 iron chariots, and the people go out. And verse 15 says, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. And he bailed out, you know, he's running away. Now, he's kind of out where Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, lives. And, you know, there's peace between Sisera and Heber the Kenite. And so he goes to their house, you know, goes to their tent. And the wife here, Yael, is there, and She said, yeah, come on in. You know, you can hide out here and I'll stand guard by the door. And he says, oh, you know, I've been running away and, you know, I want some water. Well, she gives him some milk. And, of course, not having refrigerators around, the milk's a bit warm. Gives him warm milk and tells him to lay down and puts a blanket on him. What do you think happens? He falls asleep. What do you think happens after that? She takes a tent peg and a hammer and pounds it through his skull. That's not what I was expecting. Took a tent peg, seized a hammer in her hand, went secretly to him, drove the peg into his temple, and it went through into the ground, for he was sound asleep and exhausted, so he died. I wonder if that was a needful statement. They pounded a tent peg through his temple into the ground, so he died. Okay. Well, after that, Deborah and Barak sing this song in chapter 5, since I don't know the melody, and it's a pretty long song. I'll let you read that on your own. And then guess what happens in chapter 6? The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Man, how many times has this cycle gone in your life? I can just, if I had to chart it in my own life, I would have to do the same thing. And how many times do you have to go in circles before, you know, you just stop? Then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. Well, what happened was this. The Midianites, they would come up at the time of the harvest, you know, when all the grain was growing and all the fruit was, you know, the grapes were on the vines and things. That's when the Midianites would invade every year. And so they'd come and they'd steal all the stuff and thrash on the fields and there would be nothing left. So the Israelites had been working all season growing this food and the Midianites had come in and steal it and there was this horrible famine and they didn't have any food. They ended up living in caves, you know, because they were so afraid of the Midianites. Well, it says that there's this guy named Gideon. And Gideon had managed to grow some food and was afraid the Midianites were going to come when he threshed the wheat. And so what you would do when you threshed the wheat was you'd go up to a place that was pretty windy, up at the top of a mountain, or you'd ship it off to Cheyenne, and you'd go up on top of the mountain here, and you'd take this winnowing fork and you'd throw this up in the air, and the wind would separate the wheat from the chaff. The wheat would fall down and the chaff would blow away. So it's like a separation process. You throw it up in the air and the wind separates it for you. Problem with this at this point, when they're being oppressed by the Midianites, the problem with this is that from far away, the Midianites can see this cloud, you know, as you're using your winnowing fork and threshing the wheat there, or the separating the wheat from the chaff. And so then, oh, it's harvest time. It's time to invade. So Gideon went to the wine press. Now, the wine press was always down in the valley. There's no wind down there. Grapes are heavy. And you want to carry them downhill, you know, there's no need to be up here and carry them up the hill, so they'd go into a low place. Well, it says that the angel of the Lord came as Gideon was beating out the wheat in the wine press in order to save it from the Midianites. Now, you got to realize how chicken this really looks. You know, you have to realize how, I mean, there's no wind down here. And so he's beating out the wheat and he's trying to throw it up in the air and there's no wind in here, but he's, you know, he's keeping himself safe, but this is just a sad kind of picture. Now, why is he doing this? Because he's scared to death of the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appears to him and says, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." I love that because Gideon is not known for his bravery, not here as we see him beating out wheat in the wine press. And even after the Lord calls him, you see that he's a pretty nervous and fidgety guy that he's afraid of just about everything. And so Gideon, you know, this, what a strange greeting. The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior. Gideon says, well, hey, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? Isn't that man's natural reaction all the time? That it's like, oh, if the Lord's so good, why is my life so bad? Well, maybe if you, you know, walked with the good Lord, you wouldn't have such a bad life, you know. People are so conditional in their belief and in their application. God says that he's raising him up. He tells him in verse 14, go and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. I'll be with you and I'll defeat Midian as one man. Gideon says in verse 17 that, well, you need to show me a sign to show that it's really the Lord is speaking to me. And so he says, okay, this is the deal. I'll go out and bring out an offering and I'll lay it before you. And so he makes up this whole thing and he lays this out before him. And fire springs up from the rock and consumes the meat and the unleavened bread that Gideon had made. That's pretty good proof. I mean, that's a pretty good sign that you're talking to the Lord if you make an offering and suddenly consumed by fire out of nowhere. And so he tells, the Lord says, this is what I want you to do first. Your father has an altar to Baal. I want you to tear that down. And he's got an Asherah pole right next to it, and I want you to cut that down. Well, Gideon, it says in verse 27, was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, so he did it by night. Again, you'll see that all throughout as you read the account of Gideon here. And so, you know, the guys, the men of the city, the people wake up the next day, and what do they find? They find this altar torn down. They find this Asherah pole all cut down and searched around, found out that Gideon was the guy who did it. The men of the city came to Joash, who's Gideon's dad, and says, bring out your son that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal and has cut down the Asherah pole, which was next to it. Joash said to all who stood against him. Now, Joash is an idolater. He's an unrighteous guy. He worships a false god, and yet he has some pretty good worldly wisdom here. He says, will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? Hey, how, you know, this god, you know, this god of yours, are you going to fight for him? Are you going to deliver your god? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar. Therefore, on that day, he named him Yerub-Baal, that is to say, let Baal contend against him, because he had torn down his altar. Now, so this guy, he's a fool for worshiping Baal, but he's no dummy when it comes to, hey, if our God is a real God, then you know what? He doesn't need us to defend him. He doesn't need us to fight for him. The fact is that if he's a God, he can defend himself. And if we need to rescue him, then he's not a God, is he? And so we might be able to apply that to our own understanding as well. A lot of times we feel like, oh man, you know, if I don't come through, then, you know, what's going to happen to God? Well, he was around long before you were here, and he'll be around long after you're gone. So we get to chapter 7 and we see the Lord raising up Gideon to, Gideon gets this big army together. There's 32,000 guys he gets together to go and do battle against his oppressors. Well, the Lord said to Gideon in chapter 7, verse 2, no, the people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. For Israel would become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. You got 32,000 guys. Of course you're going to win with that. We can't let that happen, right? So he tells him, Gideon, I want you to get up there and say, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him go home. Gideon was the first guy to volunteer. I'd like to go. Well, you know, it's kind of a strange thing. If you get 32,000 guys, we're guaranteed to win with this many people. It's how nerve-wracking must this be to say, whoever doesn't want to go can go home. 22,000 people said, oh good, and left. That's a lot. He's only got 10,000 left. Well, then the Lord said to Gideon, no, the people are still too many. What do you mean they're too many? So he tells him to do this certain thing and basically ends up with 300 guys left and said, I'm going to deliver you with the 300 men that you have left. And so they go, and you're probably familiar with this. It's a famous account of Gideon having these guys take clay pots and putting torches under them, and they go and kind of surround the Midianite camp, and then suddenly they break the torches and shout, and the Midianite camp just, you know, flips out and starts hacking at one another. They think they're being attacked and surrounded. They think they're in battle, and yet they're doing battle with the guy from the tent next door. You know, the Lord set the sword of one against the other, even throughout the whole army. And so they end up defeating the Midianites. And by the end of chapter 8, or about the middle of chapter 8, verse 22, the men of Israel say to Gideon, rule over us, you know, become our king. Both you and your son's son, become a king, become the beginning of a dynasty for Israel. But Gideon said to them, no, I'm not going to rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. And this was the whole intention of God in the law when he gave the law to Moses. The whole idea is we don't want a monarchy. We don't want a democracy. We want a theocracy. That is, that God needs to be the one who's in charge. So it comes about in verse 33, as soon as Gideon was dead, guess what happened? The sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. Now we see Abimelech, the son of Yerubbaal. Remember, Yerubbaal was Gideon's name that his dad gave him, meaning let Baal contend with him. So one of the sons of Gideon, Abimelech, Gideon had, 72 sons, and Abimelech decides, hey, all the Israelites wanted me to be the king, wanted me to be the ruler, you know, he wanted my dad and wanted us. Well, why give them, you know, the choice of 70 some odd people? I'll just go and wipe them out. So he went and killed his brothers. He went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Yerubbaal, 70 men on one stone, it says in verse 5. But Jotham, the youngest son of Yerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. So of 72 sons, only two were left. Abimelech, who killed all of them except Jotham, this guy. Now, Jotham in Hebrew is interesting. It means the digit hit with a hammer. Jotham. Okay, I'm just kidding. You're like, really? I should write that down. So ultimately, Abimelech rules over Israel 3 years, and he will end up. It's interesting, if you go to the end of chapter 9, verse 50, Abimelech, you know, he goes to Tebates and camps against Tebates and captures it. Well, there's a strong tower in the middle of the city, and everybody in the city runs into this tower and goes up onto the roof, you know, and hides out. Well, Abimelech says, well, that's easy enough. Let's just set this thing on fire. And he's walking up to the bottom of it. And as he's walking up to it to set it on fire, up at the top, this woman remembers this funny thing called gravity and takes this millstone and goes, and smushes him. Well, it crushed Abimelech's skull, but he wasn't quite dead. Maybe that's why Sisera, with the temple peg through his head, maybe that's why the writer of Judges said, so he died, because in this case, a millstone falls on the guy's head. He's not dead yet. He calls to the young man, his armor bearer, and said, draw your sword and kill me so that it will not be said of me, a woman slew him. So the young man pierced him through and he died. Now, interesting, the conditional morality here. He doesn't want to be known as a guy who was killed by a woman, but he didn't have any problem being known as a guy who killed 70 of his own brothers. It's amazing how people have such strange standards when they're in sin. So Abimelech dies. Says in chapter 10, verse 1, Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo. I didn't even have to say anything. This is, what a horrible family tree. In elementary school, you know, when they say, okay, kids, we're going to map out the family tree, put the names of your mom and your dad and your grandparents and things. And it's like, I could just picture him going, no. No, you just got to write down the... No. You'd never live that one down, even if you did go to Horsehead Elementary or Wrath of God Homeschool Academy, whatever it might be. That, no. Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. He becomes the judge to save Israel. I guess this is the equivalent of the boy named Sue. You know, he's so rough and tough because he's got such a lousy name that how could he not be the leader, right? So he judges Israel 23 years, and then he ends up dying. And after him, Yair the Giladite arose and judged Israel 22 years. Verse 6, guess what happens? The sons of Israel again do evil in the sight of the Lord. And so now they're sold into the hands of the Philistines. For 18 years, the Philistines afflicted Israel. Then the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. That seems to be the key number there. After 18 years, the sons of Israel always say, you know, I think that's enough suffering. Maybe we ought to cry out to God. 18 years, you know. So they cry out to God. Well, verse 11, the Lord has seen this cycle enough. He said, you know what? Verse 14, go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in this time of your distress. Have you ever stopped to consider that in the cycle of your life when, you know, I'm doing good and so I fall into sin and then things get bad, I cry out to God and God delivers me and things are good again. How many times can you go around that circle before God says, you know what? No, I'm not doing it anymore. You hit the low point on the circle and you can just stay there. You can just go ahead and stay there. How many times is that? I don't know. I don't want to go around that circle so many times that I get to the point where the Lord says, you know what? Let's just go ahead and let his body be destroyed that his soul might be saved. That's a scary thing. And the reason I said it that way is to show you that is a New Testament concept. It's not just in the old covenant, the book of Judges, where God says, you know what? No, I'm not going to. You can just, you know, you made your bed, now you're going to lie in it kind of thing. That people can approach a point of sin in their Christian lives and where God says, you know what? It's better that they die so they end up in heaven than for me to deliver them again. I'm just not going to do it. I don't want to find out how many times that is. And so he says, go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen. Let them deliver you in the time of your distress. Verse 16, this works. They put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord. And he could bear the misery of Israel no longer. You know, when they turned from their sin, it was when they were in sin and they cried out to God, God said, no, this is a temporary repentance. No, you're just crying out to me. I'm the genie in the bottle. No, I'm not playing that game. But when they really put away those foreign gods, when they really turned to God in sincerity of heart, God could bear their misery no longer. And you know, God has a heart for us. He has a heart of mercy for us. And when we really in genuineness cry out and we say, you know what, Lord, I'm not even expecting you to deliver me. I'm turning from my sin because it's messed up my life and it makes you upset. And so I'm just going to live a righteous life. Whether I ever get delivered from this or not, I'm going to live a righteous life. And when God's... Hello? There you go. Yeah, unplug the compressor for me, would you? And when God sees a life like that, then he can't help but let his heart break and bring deliverance. So then we go through, we see in chapter 11, judges, and the next judge being Jephthah, not a great guy, not a real forward thinker. And if you've read chapter 11, you know that Jephthah has a tendency to speak things a little too quickly without thinking of the ramifications. And then in chapter 12, we see that he lasted 6 years. And then chapter 12, verse 8, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel after him. Verse 11 says, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel after him. He judged Israel 10 years. And then verse 13, Abdon the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite, judged Israel after him. Well, judge after judge, cycle after cycle, verse 13, the sons of Israel again did, or I'm sorry, chapter 13, verse 1. The sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, so that the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. 18 years is enough. Now we have to go 40 years. Well, then what we see is that there's a married couple who have no children. The wife is barren, and the Lord appears to them and says, hey, you're going to give birth to a son. He's going to be a Nazarite. If you remember the Nazarite vow, we talked about this when it was a vow of dedication to the Lord where you didn't cut your hair and you didn't eat grapes or raisins or grape skins or anything and you didn't touch anything that was dead. Well, he's going to be a Nazarite to God from the womb. He's supposed to be a Nazarite his whole life, which means he's not to drink wine. He's not to touch dead things. He's not to cut his hair. Well, unfortunately, the guy this turns out to be is a guy named Samson, a guy who liked to drink wine and kill people and lions and other things, a guy who ultimately allowed his hair to be cut. And I'm sure you're familiar with the story that Samson had an unusual ability of strength that God had given to him because the Spirit of the Lord dwelt in him, and ultimately he lived such a life of sin that he was captured by the Philistines. His eyes were gouged out, and he was put in verse 21 of chapter 16. Look how far we just got. Chapter 16, verse 21, the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes. They brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze chains, and he was a grinder in the prison. And so that would be the end of a pretty miserable story of a guy who lived a life of compromise and carnality. He managed to kill quite a few Philistines along the way, but ultimately this is a pretty sad state that he found himself in. Well, the lords of the Philistines, the head honcho, said, you know what, we're going to have a festival, we're going to have a feast to our false god here, to Dagon. And so they get all these people in this arena together, or this large house, this palace kind of thing, and says, hey, you know what? Remember that Samson guy that killed so many of us? Now his eyes are all gouged out, and he's just a grinder in the prison. Why don't we bring him out into this big public area and watch him stumble around? That'll make us feel pretty good and make us feel like our god Dagon is better than the god of the Israelites. And so he's stumbling around and things, and says to this guy who's this boy that was holding his hand, leading, you know, he's being led around the hound by this boy. And he says, oh, you know, let me lean up against the pillars of the house. You know, I need to steady myself, kind of thing. And then he prays, says that, God, please remember me and strengthen me just this time, O Lord, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes. Now there's 3,000 people on the top part of the roof, basically, above these pillars. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. He bent with all his might, so the house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So he pushed the pillars apart, and the whole thing just came down. And he died, but he died killing these 3,000 Philistines. But what a sad statement. I mean, the whole life of Samson. You know, we call Samson one of the heroes of the Bible. I don't see anything about Samson that I want to duplicate, that I want to imitate. There was nothing in his life that made me go, oh, what a godly guy. Now, God used him to judge the Philistines, and yet there's nothing that I see about Samson that I want to be like. Chapter 17, verse 6 pretty much epitomizes the whole book of Judges in the times between the judges. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. That's pretty much like we've got today in the United States. We just do what feels good. If it feels right, do it. Hey, I'm okay. You're okay. You do your thing. I'll do my thing. Don't preach at me. Don't judge me. Tolerance. Isn't that the definition of the word tolerance? Every man doing what is right in his own eyes? That's a pretty good definition of tolerance to me. And so as we go through, and this book gets pretty graphic and gross by the time we get to chapter 19, we see that there's a Levite, and the Levites are supposed to be serving God. Well, this Levite, instead of serving God, has a live-in girlfriend that he considers his wife, but it's just his concubine. And so they have a nasty breakup, and then he goes, oh, please take me back. And so they're on their way home, and they stop off at this place, and ultimately she is done very graphic violence to by the inhabitants of this city, and killed. Well, the Levite chops her body up into 12 pieces and basically mails them, sends them by messenger to the tribes of Israel and says, you know, this is what's been done. When people say, man, you know, you mailed me the 12th of a body here. What's the story here? He answers and says, this is chapter 20, verse 4. He said, well, I came with my concubine to spend the night at Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose up against me, surrounded the house because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. And I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, and sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance, for they have committed a lewd and disgraceful act. And so the people of Israel, the tribes of Israel, send guys to the tribe of Benjamin and said, what is this wickedness that has taken place? You deliver up these guys, these wicked Gileadites, the ones who did this. You deliver them up so that we could kill them. Well, the tribe of Benjamin said, not a chance. Can you imagine not letting people who have done such a horrible act be extradited to be prosecuted? That they said, no. No, and they proved that they themselves were so wicked, the sons of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brothers. The sons of Benjamin instead, it says in verse 14, gathered to go out to battle against the sons of Israel. No, they'd rather fight than turn over these guys that have done such a horrible, horrible thing. Ultimately, for example, verse 35, the Lord struck Benjamin before Israel so that the sons of Israel destroyed them. And they swear at this point, we're not going to allow any of us to give our daughters to any Benjamite. They swore in this because why would we allow our daughters to marry into such a wicked, wicked tribe? And they killed all of the guys of fighting age just about. And then they realized in chapter 21, they realized, wow, we've just almost completely wiped out the tribe of Benjamin, and we swore that we wouldn't let our daughters marry any of them, so they're pretty close to extinction. And so they cry out, and they say in chapter 21, verse 3, why, O Lord God of Israel, has this come about in Israel, that one tribe should be missing today in Israel? Like it's God's fault or something. They performed wickedness, they dealt with it rashly and wrongly, and now they're crying out to God. They were sorry, it says in verse 6, for their brother Benjamin and said, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord not to give any of our daughters in marriage? Have you ever gotten yourself in such a pickle where you said, oh man, I just made a promise and that really messed things up. And now you're having to go, okay, well, I already eliminated this option. So now what am I going to do? And the Benjamites, they're not going to have any wives. Because and we can't give them any wives, so what are we going to do? So they said, got an idea. When we went up to war against the Benjamites, was there any cities who didn't send any army guys? Was there anyone who didn't send any men to the battle? Oh yeah, it turned out that when they gathered together at Mitzpah, that no one had come to the camp from Yabesh Gilead. Yabesh Gilead, the city of Yabesh Gilead, they did not send any of them. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to go and kill the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilead and take all their young women that have not known men and give them as wives to the Benjamites. You know, it's this whole two wrongs will make a right kind of thing. They were mourning. They were saying, oh, we ended up killing almost all the Benjamites. Now we go, what are we going to do? Oh, I know. We'll kill all the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilead. That makes much more sense. So they found among the inhabitants of Yabesh Gilead 400 young virgins. And so they brought Benjamin back into the fold. You know, they said, oh, here's 400 wives. Well, it wasn't enough. See, there was more than 400 guys left in the tribe of Benjamin. So when they gave them these 400 women, that wasn't enough. And so they said in verse 17, well, there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin so that a tribe will not be blotted out from Israel. But we can't give them wives of our daughters because we swore and said, no, we're not going to do that. Cursed is he who gives a wife to Benjamin. It's amazing that they haven't considered any of the curses of the law, like thou shalt not kill. And you know, cursed is he when he does such things that, I would be cursed if I broke my word here. So ultimately, they said, you know, that there's a feast of the Lord from year to year in Shiloh on the north side of Bethel, on the east side of the highway that goes from Bethel to Shechem, and on the south side of Lebanon. And they commanded the sons of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in wait in the vineyards. Go to where this party's going on, this festival. Go to where it is and hide out in the vineyards, and the girls will start dancing. Well, when the girls start dancing, run out from the vineyard and grab who you want to be your wife. They all thought that was a great idea. And so ultimately they said, you know, when you guys capture these women and drag them off and you go get married to them, their dads are going to complain to us. But we're going to say this. We're going to say that, we didn't take them. and don't forget, you didn't give them. Because if you gave them, you would be cursed. But because they were taken and you didn't give, see, that's okay then. What a mess. Guess how the book of Judges ends. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. What a horrible, nasty time to be alive. When sin just is so rampant, just like today. When people do what they want to do, just like today. When even people who claim to be believers come up with the dumbest ways to sin, just like today. Hopefully, we won't be going through that cycle, that although the world wants to go through that cycle, that we won't. That's my prayer. And just so you know, although this book really reeks of sin, when we get into the next book, the book of Ruth, it's going to be a sweet smell. Let's pray.